All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck Knicks, what the fucksters? What the fuck is going on? Okay, you can let your kids listen now. I hope your commute's going well, your bike ride's going well. If you're swimming and listening, that's interesting. Perhaps you're in the shower, in the bathroom, or cleaning something. I hope it's all going all right. And thank you for listening to my show in your cubicle, trying to look like you're working. Glad to be here. Today on the show, the amazing Annie Baker is here. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright of The Flick, which is currently running at the Barrow Street Theater in New York. I saw her other play, John, a big fan of hers. And I believe this marks the first time we've had a playwright on the show. Also, Australia, not excited about flying there. It's going to happen. I'm coming. When you're listening to this, I may be suspended in the air, moving fast over water. A lot of water. Not my favorite thing. Don't know. It's going to be what it's going to be. I'm going to get there. We've made some, it looks like Sydney and Melbourne are okay with the ticket sales. Should be about 1,000 or so folks at each one. You can still get tickets. You can go to WTFpod.com/calendar for tickets. Brisbane, we've accommodated the lack of ticket sales by moving to a smaller venue, right within the same structure. So you don't have to do anything too extreme, but it'll be nice. It'll be better. It's going to be okay. It's better than canceling. Looking forward to being there. I'm going to be funny. I'll probably be tired, loopy. I will not have a clear idea of where I am or what my body clock is doing, but maybe something interesting will come out of that. Maybe I'll have an emotional meltdown on stage in Australia. God knows I've done it before, but that was decades ago. It'll be compelling. Might not be the show you expect, but we'll make something of it. Won't we, Australia? I believe we will. I had a therapist back in San Francisco when I lived there in the early 90s, a guy named Jonathan Rosenfeld. And I've quoted him here before. He once said to me that, I don't remember exactly what the context was, but I never forgot it. He said, there's no such thing as boredom, only fear. And that thing is sort of, I've kind of like rolled that around in my mental mouth for a long time, you know, kind of sucked on that with my brain for a while. And it's always up there. And I thought it was very provocative and insightful. So somebody had told him that I'd said that, or I'd quoted him on the show, and he reached out to me through the direct message function on Twitter. We were actually able to have dinner the other night. He was here in LA on business. I hadn't seen him in over 20 years, really. It's probably been that long. And when I was seeing him as a therapist, he was just working on his PhD, seemed like a fairly, a bit of a dark dude. I felt like we had common things. We shared a disposition, but maybe that was just part of him enabling me the benefit of transference for the sake of therapy. So it was kind of weird to see this man who was my therapist, not that much older than me, so many years later. And he's sort of gone beyond therapy, did a lot of work with family therapy and setting up a new style of family therapy practices over the years. But this is the thing. This is the thing. After we talk for a while, he tells me that meditation changed his life. And I've heard this a few times, and it's not specific. It's not, you know, it doesn't need to have a label in terms of, you know, what brand of meditation, but meditation as a practice changed his brain, changed his life. So I downloaded a meditation app, and maybe I'll get to that. I know it's just about breathing and sitting still and turning off your brain. I think I'm capable of that. My intellectual brain doesn't think there's any benefit to it. But why not just try it? I think I've tried it a few times in my life, but I'm really hearing some good shit about this. So look forward to that, the possibility of a meditated Marc Maron. How is that even fucking possible? Jesus, man. Look, here we go. Let's talk about this, about the Lorne Michaels interview, looking for some sort of closure or acknowledgement, justice, whatever it may be. I realize some of you are new to the show, and you might not understand why having Lorne Michaels as a guest on my show, or me talking to Lorne Michaels, is as important as it seems to be. Here's the deal. almost since the start of this show, I've talked about the SNL audition I had with Lorne. All right, this was like 1994, 95. It played a big role in my psyche, and it served as a point of connection for me and a lot of people that I've had on this show. And what I mean by that is I've had a lot of people who have been on SNL or have auditioned for SNL, and I am constantly looking for information about Lorne Michaels. I had this one meeting with him so many years ago, and it's defined my entire sense of the man, and I'm looking to put him together as a human being through the stories of others, and I'm always looking for bad things. I'd like to sort of hang a certain amount of evil and sensitivity on the man, or at worst, a bit of a mind fucking. This has been hanging over me for decades. And the first time I talked about it, it was all the way back in episode 45 of this show of WTF. I told the Lorne Michaels audition story for the first time at the urging of my guest, one of the founding members of the Upright Citizens Brigade, Matt Walsh. And this is a clip of Matt provoking me to tell the story that has become sort of an obsession and a signature and a underlying theme of the duration of this podcast. So this is Matt Walsh and myself on episode 45 of WTF.
You have a great Lorne Michaels story.
Oh, God.
Have you told it on air?
I don't know if I've told it here.
Do a quick tell, just real quick. That's one of my favorite stories of yours. I'm pimping the host.
But. Oh, okay. So what happens is, you know, I audition for SNL. They make me jump through a few hoops. Marcy Klein sees me do stand-up, and then she wants to see me again. She brings Lorne to the comic strip. He sits there and watches me do stand-up, and then they take me to the studio. It was Conan's studio, actually, and do a screen test with me, and then I have a meeting
the
with
meeting,
Lorne.
Yeah.
And the thing about the meeting with Lorne, at that time, I was smoking a lot of pot, and I was reading one of Bruce Wagner's books. You know, and he writes about Hollywood. And I was really sitting there, because you sit for hours, and it was just me and Tracy Morgan, because he was meeting Lorne that day, too, and his hair was so shiny. Like he looked, you know, like, it was, like, perfect.
Like gelled, or?
Yeah, it was just, like, a perfect, you know, black natural fro, and just glistened.
Now, was this as a writer or performer?
Performer,
yeah,
right.
Cool.
The idea was that they were going to, you know, use me on Update, you know, because Norm was on the fence or something. But I'm reading this book and I'm high. I'm a little high because I could not be high for some reason. You know how you do that when you smoke pot? You're like, you know, I smoke pot pretty much every day, but I don't want to smoke a lot today because I got this meeting. But if I smoke now, I still got 3 hours, you know.
To come down.
Yeah, that shit. To level off. So I'm a little high. I'm reading Bruce Wagner's I'm Losing You or something. And it's all dark and weird and about Hollywood. And now I can't tell the difference between the book and what's happening with me a little bit. And I waited like 3 hours. And I go in to see Lorne. And he's sitting behind his desk. And Higgins is there, the head writer. And there's a picture on his desk, you know, pictures. And then like on my side of his desk is a bowl of candies. And he sits me down and he goes, literally, like one of the first things, it was when we were doing, I think, Luna, at the beginning of Luna, and there had been press on it in the New York Times. And Lorne says, you know, I don't know what you think you're doing down there below 14th Street, but it really doesn't matter. And I'm like, hey, okay, how you doing? You know? And then all of a sudden, Lorne just, you know, stops talking and starts looking at me right in the eyes. And I'm looking at him, and Higgins is actually like, what the fuck's going on? He goes, you can tell a lot by a person's eyes by looking into them, you know. So it was really fucking weird. You know, and I start talking about the original SNL, like, I was a big fan. He goes, well, there's been plenty of good casts. You know, that was not the best one. And I'm like, wow, this is not going well. And I keep looking at this candy, you know, and I'm just sitting there and I'm a little high and this is weird as fuck. And then he like, he sits back, you know, and he does this sort of pondering thing. He's like, you know, comedians are like monkeys. You know, when people go to the zoo, they look like the lion because it's scary and the bear is intense, but the monkey makes people laugh. So I said, you know, as long as they're not throwing shit at you. And he just like looks over, you know, he doesn't do anything. And then like I reached for a candy, for a Jolly Roger candy. It was Jolly Roger. And I go down, like I reach the candy, I take it up, I unwrap it. And right when the wrapper starts unwrapping, Lorne shoots a look at the writer, at Higgins, like it had been decided. Like, that candy was somehow connected to my not getting...
That was the moment. And you felt that was real. Like, you kind of... Because I believe that.
I was a little high, but, like, I had somehow failed the test. Like, it was all hinging on the Jolly Roger candy.
Yeah.
And I left there just completely mind-fucked. And, you know, they left me dangling for weeks. But I, in retrospect, from what I understand, I was just being used to scare Norm.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
But I like to believe that if you didn't take the candy, you would be on SNL today. That's a better story.
Now, that story has remained very consistent in my mind over the years, with the exception of the fact that I meant to say Jolly Ranchers and not Jolly Rogers. What is Jolly Roger? Jolly Ranchers. That was what I was trying to say. And the fact is, I guess I've always wondered what it would mean if I got some answers about that story. Now, obviously, there's a little paranoia working. Maybe. I don't know. It's been very easy all these years to give Lorne Michaels this sort of Buddha slash sorcerer slash mythological power, because all I've had to do is think about it. My life could have gone in a completely different direction had it gone the other way. So there was a different periods of obsessing about it and wondering about it and reading the mystical implications, the things that transcended coincidence into almost magic. And now the thing is, now that I have these answers, do I want to share them? Because as I said, this is an arc, man, in my life, on this show. You know, what happens after that? What happens after I share them? Okay, well, we'll see what happens, folks. Okay? We'll see what happens. Okay, so now Annie Baker, I'll tell you, man, her plays blew me away. I saw both of them. I was turned on to her by Scott Rudin, who sent the show an email. And it's my understanding, if I understand Hollywood history, if Scott Rudin sends you an email or perhaps would like you to do something, it might behoove you to look into what he's asking you to do. And I was blown away. He was right. Annie Baker is a phenomenal talent. And I saw both plays that I could, The Flick and John, when I was in New York with Brendan McDonald. And I loved both of them. And so it was a really exciting thing for me to talk to a Pulitzer Prize winning playwright who is not what I expected. It's interesting because plays can be very cryptic and very abstract. And her plays are no different than that, where you sort of wonder, like, why decide to do it this way? Or where did that come from? You know, how do you know when something like this is done? So it was very exciting for me to talk to a playwright. And it was even more exciting that that playwright was Annie Baker. So this is me talking to Annie Baker in New York City. I went to the shows. Scott Rudin reached out to me personally, which is scary. I don't know what your experience with him, but for me, I don't know him.
Yeah.
Then I got an email from Scott Rudin saying, you know.
Yeah, it's sort of titillating and scary to see his name in your inbox.
Sure, sure. Like, what I do, is this the end?
Yeah.
Wait, there's nothing. He can't hurt me.
Yeah. Or maybe it's my big break.
Right.
You're like, maybe he's going to cast me in a movie.
No, I think that boat sailed for me. But he was in sort of excited for me and you to talk. And then he sent me a bunch of your plays with a little card. I think it said compliments of Scott Rudin, like a card.
Oh, yeah. I've gotten one of those. Yeah. It's really exciting.
It kind of is.
Yeah.
But if it weren't for Scott Rudin.
I can't believe he sent you my plays.
Yeah, no,
I
need.
That's crazy. Wow, okay.
How did he find you? What's your relationship with him? Because of him, I saw your plays and I'm aware of you. I'm not, you know, I don't live in New York. I'm not a huge theater head, so I wouldn't have known.
Right.
So how'd you meet Scott Rudin?
I'm trying to remember I think he is sort of like an all-seeing eye. And I think my second or third play in New York, which was actually like a tiny play with like 75 seat audience in like the West Village in like a church. It was at this place called the Rattlestick Playwrights Theater, and it ran for like 4 weeks and like could barely fit people into the theater, but he like somehow saw, you know, he saw it because he's Scott Rudin.
Right.
And then called me in for a meeting, and then I've sort of known him ever since.
So you went in for the meeting?
Yeah.
And was it scary? Were you like intimidated? Were you like whatever?
No. I'm actually like, I'm not, when I'm not being recorded, I'm weirdly not that nervous or intimidated by people.
Uh-huh.
There is something, I'm like more, it's like I'm, I'm way more scared of like being permanently recorded as an idiot, but like just be like being witnessed as an idiot for one afternoon by Scott Rudin.
Right.
Wasn't so bad.
Yeah.
He was like, would you ever let me make a movie?
Movie. That was the first pitch.
Of that play.
Which
he was
one?
Like, would
the
you
one
ever
he
be
saw?
This was my play, The Aliens.
Uh-huh.
And I said no. And then he was like, okay. And we sort of eyed each other, and then we've had a relationship ever since. But he's so smart. He's like the smartest.
Yeah, he's done some great stuff.
He's the smartest producer out there, I think.
What was The Aliens about?
The Aliens was about kind of the town I grew up in and all the weird bearded guys who would sort of like hang out near the trash cans where I grew up. And it's like the townies, for lack of a better
word.
Amherst, Massachusetts.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like a college town in Western Massachusetts. And it's like a lot of there. It's like it's a weird mix of people. And there are a lot of like guys in sweatpants with guitars.
The
and
ones that
beards
sort of like,
who are sort of like pseudo homeless.
Yeah. But college-y somehow.
But little
college-y homeless.
Yeah, college-y homeless who like came to this town because it was like a fun place to
right.
be.
Right.
And there's like a big heroin problem in Vermont and Western Massachusetts right now. And I was interested in writing about that.
Jay Maskus is from there. You guys buddies?
Oh, no. Right. He's from Northampton. But
his dad was a dentist.
His dad was a dentist in Northampton. But he was just like the cool, awesome story when I was a teenager.
Okay.
I was so like, maybe you could become Jay Maskus. Like there's like a few people from that area.
So you sort of, you were not a mainstream person. You were already from the get go.
Yeah, I was like artier than I am now.
I was like
all the way. I like, you know, I was lonely and sad and I didn't have anything to do.
Small
so
town.
I was like, yeah, so I was like crazy arty and like angry and
you're
I thought I was smarter than everybody else.
Because you were surrounded by college kids too, so you could be that person, right?
Yeah, a little. And I just like I don't know, there's really nothing to do but like get mad and like drive around with your friends at night.
Yeah.
And then there's like cool guys who seem really cool because they're in their 30s
right.
and you're like 17.
Yeah.
And I started hanging out with them. And they have drug problems and they write their own music. And
so when you were 17, you were hanging out with the guys at the trash can.
Yeah.
Because they were the real thing.
Yeah. Well, when I was kind of like a pretty good kid, like nerdy with glasses and like... And then when I was 16, I like dated a cute towny guy and he introduced me to like the whole world of like people who have like drumming circles next to the pond in the middle of the night and stuff.
The post hippie.
Yeah. And like everyone's shrooming
right.
and it's, and I got into that crowd and it was
dreads and smells.
Yeah. Dreads and smells. And, but it's like, it was kind of an amazing group of people and I got really close to them. And then years later, you'd hear that people had died and it's.
Yeah.
It's a really specific world that I hadn't seen portrayed before.
Wait, you have siblings or you don't?
I do. I grew up with an older brother.
That's important.
Yeah.
How much older?
3.5 years.
That's
which
enough.
Is like, yeah, which is enough for him to like introduce me to cool music,
right.
but also hate me.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well,
so
that tension is necessary.
Yeah. He hated me and he thought I was dumb, but I was like a good pupil.
Right.
So
in those moments where you actually connected, it was around like him showing you cool stuff.
Him showing me cool stuff and cool music. And I remember when we were younger, he and his friends would be playing video games. Mm-hmm. And I was like in love with that. I was like in love with all of his like nerdy friends just because they
He's
were
nerdy
years.
Too.
Yeah. We were both.
Oh, that's lucky.
Super nerdy. But his group of friends said that I could come hang out with them if they could use me as a footstool. So I would like I remember as a kid, like just like lying, like crouching in a little ball on the floor of my brother's bedroom and them like resting their feet on me. And I was like, this is great.
How old were you?
I get to hang out with these guys, you know, probably like 8 and they were 11.
Borderline abusive.
Yeah. I was telling that like it was like a cute story. And then your face like fell and you looked.
Well, if you were 12, it would have been a problem.
Yeah.
11 and,
yeah,
and
yeah,
7,
11, yeah,
8.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. It's cute.
Yeah.
What'd your folks do in Amherst?
My mom growing up was a therapist.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What kind?
Well, she worked at a clinic in Northampton for mostly children who were abuse survivors.
Mm-hmm.
And then she was also like going back to school while she was doing that job and trying to get her PhD in psychology. And I remember once like the husband, she was like testifying in court for one of the abused kids, and like the husband showed up in our backyard, like threatening us. Like there was some, she was like part of that world.
Right.
And then, so my brother and I lived with her, and then my dad lived in New York City, actually.
Here?
Yeah.
Still?
No. He lives in D.C.
When they get divorced?
Six.
You were six.
Yeah. Are your parents still together?
No. They're still alive, not together.
Every episode I've listened to of your show, everyone's parents are divorced. It might just be a coincidence which ones are we all from divorced parents?
Some peoples are still alive, but I think most people in general, in a certain world, the parents are divorced.
Yeah.
It seems pretty common. What effect it has on these all change. My parents didn't get divorced till I was in my 30s. So it's really, it's hard for me to figure out.
Do you feel like they should have gotten divorced earlier?
I don't know. Probably. I mean, there was so much weird self-involved lying going on. Like I didn't know until later, but I don't know that I really felt that connected to them in general.
So when you were 15, if someone was like, are your parents happy together? You would have been like, I don't know.
Yeah, because I just never really saw them as parents. They were just these people that I grew up with. They seemed to have some problems, and they needed a lot of attention.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, what's your relationship like with your parents?
My mom and I are really close.
She's still doing therapy?
Yeah. She started teaching psychology after she got her doctorate up in New Hampshire, and she just retired 2 months ago. She and I are really close. We were like too close when I was a kid.
Sure.
Like now I feel like it's really good. We're like friends.
She was leaning on you when you were a kid?
Well, I actually just think it's that thing when you're a single parent, especially after my brother went to college, it's just like a 15-year-old girl and a 50-year-old woman like living together and you're both single. You know what I mean? It's like, it's just really intense. Like we were just like a couple.
Right.
And I don't know who I'd be without like sitting at the kitchen table with her, like mm-hmm. really late at night and like talking about everything.
Mm-hmm.
But so that's like a huge part of my life and I wouldn't ever take that away. But I am like, that's great. Like we talked, like my friends would hear the kind of conversations I had with my mother and just be like, what?
But that's good.
But mostly good, you know, occasionally you don't want to hear about everything. And I think as a kid, I always asked a lot of questions and I was very curious, but I was the kind of kid that like asked the question that I didn't actually want to know the answer to.
Like
about like sex and like, you want your mom to talk about sex, like to a certain point.
But she's
and then
a therapist.
You like,
she's
and then you
lay
like,
don't,
she laid it out. She right. laid it out big time. And
but not just the biology of it. Like,
yeah.
Too
much information. And looking back, you're like, she's cool.
So it's a boundary issue.
She's a cool
issue,
lady. Yeah, the two of us had some boundary issues.
Like,
And I like hated all our boyfriends. And, you know, it was like, I was like a jealous husband.
Uh-huh. Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah.
What's your dad do?
He's done a lot of different things. This sort of. He's an environmentalist. That's sort of what all his jobs have been related to.
Yeah.
I don't know. I meet people who like whose parents told them that they were going to be like that they were going to be great artists when they grew up or that they could, you know, the whole like you can do anything,
right.
You know, I'll probably tell my kids.
Yeah.
But there is a weird entitlement, I think, to people who think who knew they were going to do great things or I don't know. I never had that. I was sure I'm just trying to like avoid being homeless in the gutter. And so that makes me very happy that I'm always very grateful that I get to be an artist because it's legitimately a pleasant surprise. Like I did not think it would happen.
Did you have jobs?
I had so many jobs and I was just sure that that's what I'd be doing for the rest of my life. I was totally resigned to that. And I was really good
like
at finding jobs.
Just
I was
doing
looking,
jobs.
Yeah. Period? I was like, I'm going to have a series of jobs and I'll try to find I'll try to have a job that doesn't make me want to kill myself and I'll have that job and then I'll die. And that's what I get.
That was the dream.
That's what I get.
That's what you get.
Yeah. But really, and that's what most people get, you know? And so I am really lucky.
But I
had tons of jobs and I was really good. It's weird because I'm really lazy and ineffective in lots of areas of my life, but I've always been really good at finding jobs. So I was like, working in the bakery after school when I was in high school. I was like the youngest person there by like 15 years. And then
making bread and muffins?
I just like sold cookies at the
counter. Oh, you didn't
get
to bake?
I didn't get to bake anything.
But were the bakers there?
The bakers were
How
there.
How great is that to work in a place where they bake?
It was great. And then if a cookie breaks, you get to eat it. You're and then I'd just like be breaking cookies when they weren't looking.
Sure.
And I was just like babysitting all the time. You know, I just was like always working and always like saving money. And then I worked throughout college and
were you
had
writing
like a million different jobs. I was writing, but I wasn't showing it to anybody because I also I was writing short stories. I wrote a play. And I like submitted it to some some student play contest in the high school. Yeah, like a short play. And then I, what's the opposite of submitting? I rescinded it like the night before. I was like, actually, never mind. And then I like took it back because it was so bad. And, you know, I was really self-hating and hated everything I wrote and sort of did it in secret.
Why do you think you were self-hating?
I don't know. I do think it's partly like having an older brother and a father who were like really into like movies and books and like talking about all that stuff. I do think that I always felt like anything I produced wasn't as good as I knew something. I always held myself. It's like at 15, I held myself to the standard I hold myself to now, which is like I want to make something really good, and it's so painful when you're 15
and
you're
like,
and I'm a stupid 15-year-old, so I can't do it. But I like knew I never had the thing where I was like, maybe it's really good. I always knew I was like an idiot high school student, and it's so painful.
Right.
And so then all the high school students who were like doing stuff and thinking it was good, I like couldn't identify with them.
But
I still feel that way. Actually, I'm still like, I haven't like this is terrible what I'm doing. Like, what's wrong with you idiots that you think this is like? Yeah, I'm not just being self-deprecating. I am like. But there's a kind of like actually like
you know you won the Pulitzer Prize?
I did, but I had the same feeling where I was like, this? I could do so much better than this. I mean, it's actually very egotistical. Like if you it's actually kind of like I could be so much better.
Right. Did you rescind the Pulitzer? Like look,
yeah,
this
I
is
like
a mistake.
Sent the play where I'm like, I think you guys you're
it's
wrong.
Really not that good. I want to take the play back. I don't know who submitted this.
I would have if I could have.
Really?
Seriously. Yeah, seriously.
But probably there's probably a broader series of pressures and reasons than just being a 15-year-old.
Yeah. No, clearly it's like still going on for me now.
But now sort of like, you know, the expectations or the what you would see as expectations once you win something like that, which is a pretty big fucking deal.
Yeah.
You're sort of like, oh, my God, no. Now what?
Yeah. Although I feel like my own expectations for myself have always been so high because people have asked me, they've been like, do you feel pressure now that you won this award to like, you know, the next thing you do has to be really good. And I actually feel like the amount of pressure I've exerted on myself is so high my whole life that it's like, it actually doesn't. I don't feel
it's
more
not gonna
pressure
change.
Now. Yeah, I'm already like crippled under the weight of the pressure I put on myself.
Because it's interesting about self-hatred.
I don't know why that's funny. Keep going. Yeah, keep going.
No, it is because, you know, some people have it. And it's a really hard thing to shake, that type of judgment on yourself. And some people don't have it. I don't meet a lot of people that, you know, are necessarily really confident, but they don't do the thing where they second guess everything, and even when they have success they're like, nah, it's okay, you know, that thing that there's no moment of relief or sense of accomplishment that would, you know, give you the self-esteem even for a minute that was sort of like,
well, it's so the self, because I don't know, like I don't hate, if I think about it, like I don't hate myself,
right?
Like I like myself okay. Like I actually think I'm like a pretty good friend.
Mm-hmm.
And like a pretty good girlfriend. Like I'm not great. You know, I'm like okay. But I'm like, I don't beat myself up about it.
Right.
Well, actually, that's not true. But I don't. It's different. I'm like, I'm like, I would want to be friends with me. Like I'm a nice lady. But but then when it comes to like making art, it's like that's a whole different story. And that is about like, what's the point? It just feels like such an indulgent thing to be able to do, and so many people on this planet like don't get to do that and don't have the opportunity to express themselves creatively for their job. I mean, it's so crazy that we get to do that. So then I do feel this like enormous pressure and enormous amount of, I don't know if it's self-hatred, but just like, maybe it's self-hatred, but just like, I better fucking make this really amazing. And then when it's not really amazing, I feel like shit. But maybe, I don't know if that's self-hatred. Do you hate yourself?
I do it in a very specific way. Like, you know, generally I think I'm okay with myself, but I do have like weird body issues for a dude. And I do,
wait, what are your weird body issues?
I just always feel like I'm like doughy.
You're not, you don't look doughy.
See, now it's gone for a second. See what you did? Thank you. This interview's been great for me.
But no, but have you always felt that way, though? You've like, since you were a kid, you were like, I'm doughy.
So like, it was,
yeah.
That was her way that she bonded with me. Her lack of boundaries was concern for me being fat.
Oh. And were you ever fat?
Chubby.
But like every kid's chubby.
Right. Yeah. She fucked me up for good.
Yeah.
But it's deep.
Yeah, yeah.
But like in terms of professionally, I never think I put the right amount of time into my bits. I don't think that my comedy is as strong as it could be. I'll compare myself to other people, you know, like my friends who are, you know, either more successful or who I think are more more funny or more, you know, have a structure. Like my process is my process. Anyone's process is whatever.
Right.
But I always think like if I was a little more disciplined and I didn't write like that.
Yeah.
Then I'd be much better. But does it stop me? No.
Yeah. So I definitely feel like I don't work hard enough.
Right. We perpetuate it. It's our way of motivating.
Yeah.
But when your parents got divorced, are you friends with your dad?
Yeah. So yeah. I mean, cool. I grew up with my mom more.
Right.
But yeah, we're friendly. It's cool.
But you didn't feel like, you know, it was your fault and all that shit?
It wasn't my fault. No. You know, I was young enough that I don't remember. I definitely was like depressed and sad about it. Mm-hmm. I think worse than actually your parents getting divorced. Mm-hmm. For me, I shouldn't speak for other people. For me, worse than the divorce itself, because my parents like shouldn't have been together. It was like very clear. It was one of those divorces where afterwards you were like, I have no idea why those two people.
My whole life's been a lie.
Would have ever gotten together. They're so different.
Right.
Like even just the two of them talking in the room at like a high school graduation seems surreal. But I think harder for me was like, the whole like parents dating other people thing and like people coming in and out of my lives and like my parents marrying people. And then they were just like single people in the '80s.
Right. So a lot of people coming through.
Yeah. There were a lot of people coming through on both sides. And that was the hard part. That's the thing where I look back and I'm like, oh, that sucked. Like having to meet people and, get to know them and like being asked to consider them your family and then them like disappearing when your parent breaks up with them. Like that whole thing fucked with my head. And I think if I ever have kids, that's the thing I would really want to try not to do if I ever like got divorced, would be like the whole, the whole like introducing your kid to people you're dating madness thing. But hard to avoid too.
It's interesting, and I'm sure you've made the connection that, you know, trying to figure out what a relationship is and whether they're possible and whether you can have one that'll stay and is some theme you work with.
In my work?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is it? Yeah, I guess. You know, the play you saw last night, John, was like the first play where I'd ever really tried to like tackle a romantic relationship. I think I've always really avoided that. And that was my first play where I was like, oh, I want to write about like the mind fuck of being in a relationship like in its last stage.
But last stage at 3 years.
Last stage of three. Yeah. Like that thing where
like
you
a young
like,
relationship yeah, of young people.
Young people when you shouldn't be together, yeah, but you're like working really hard and you don't know yourself well enough to know that you should just leave.
Right.
And that whole thing. And then you think there's something wrong with you and that whole cycle. I was interested in writing about that, but that's like another thing. I really hesitated writing about it because I do think like so many plays and movies about relationships, there is a point where I'm like, why do I care? It's just like
But also there
it
was
has to feel a little universal and not just about like
right
two people in love and breaking up.
Well, I didn't feel that that was the primary story, but the idea of what is permanent and what is you know unconditional and what is you know bigger than us.
Yeah.
And what stays throughout.
Well, that's the hardest thing for me about becoming an adult was this whole idea. Like, I think I would have fared. That's not true. I'm going to say something that's not true. But I think I would have fared better in like one of those societies where you like married your first girlfriend or boyfriend. And then you're just like stuck with them and you're not allowed to get divorced.
Uh-huh.
I don't actually wish that's what had happened. But the whole thing where like you could fall in love with people and even live with them and like have Thanksgiving with them and then break up, which is kind of what being in your 20s is about now, killed me. Like I couldn't believe that because I'd grown up with that and I didn't want to do
painful.
That. Yeah. And just ludicrous to me, like bringing someone in that close to you and like trying to make someone family and then it failing and then you never see each other again. And I would try to be friends with all my ex-boyfriends because I was like, how can we not be in each other's lives anymore? You know, I was like, it was very, very hard for me to accept the idea that like people leave your life sometimes.
It's horrible.
And that you can initiate, like that I would initiate that, that I'd be the person who would end something also killed me. Like I couldn't, like I could, that was, I'd feel like that was like my most self-hating moment was like in my mid 20s when I was like, I'm hurting people and ending things. And that really killed me. And I do feel like that's related to like, being a
coming,
child of
going.
Divorce. Yeah.
People coming
I just didn't
want going.
To do that myself. And then, of course, I did.
And it must.
How can you not?
No, it's impossible not to.
Yeah.
And still honor your feelings if you just, unless you just luck out. But I think it's interesting that the idea of, it's not the society you talk about where you're supposed to be with the person that you I mean, that it, the idea of marriage is sort of that.
Yeah.
But there was no reason that you would ever believe in it given what you grew up with. It didn't seem rational.
Yeah, I wanted it very badly though. Like I loved the idea of like meeting someone at 18 and being with them for the rest of your life. I was like, that sounds great. That sounds so stable.
But you'd have to turn a lot of your brain off.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And suck up a lot of things where, you know, in the culture we live in as you know, ideas about individuality and psychology evolve, you know, we've grown to try to service ourselves more than others in relationship and protect that. I don't know, you know, there's no
that's the hardest thing.
It is the hardest thing and it's all about compromise, you know, having like I'm older than you and I've, you know, been through a couple marriages and some painful shit, but and I don't like it and it's really kind of awful. It's I like, but I'm just realizing now as you talk about it that if I look at the two plays I saw, this idea of grieving, you know, absence of somebody for whatever reason, and the loneliness of longing, and then also the sort of the weird painful loneliness of losing or deciding to not be with somebody you loved is like, that's a human thing. It's everybody has that. They're just walking around with at some state of heartbreak.
Yeah.
Managing heartbreak.
Yeah, and I never wanted to betray anybody. That was always my thing. Like as a teenager and someone in my early 20s, I was always like, I'm never going to betray anybody. Yeah. But like of course we just go through life betraying everybody all the time and ourselves, and it's just a matter of like managing it and talking about it and like
rationalizing it
and trying to minimize it. Mm-hmm. But I just never wanted to make anyone feel bad or betrayed ever.
Yeah.
And then I, of course, the sad thing too is when you also like have that goal, then you end up betraying people left and like, then you're just like not in touch with your desires and then you screw lots of people over.
Right. Well, that's the trap.
And then,
and then you're hard on yourself.
Yeah.
And then
you
get to honor that, like, I'm not good.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
Wow. I figured it all out.
Yeah.
So when did you decide to, pursue theater for real? I mean, why did you go to college? Like you were working and doing your jobs and breaking cookies.
Right.
And you know, you didn't have a big plan for yourself. Did your parents say like you should go to college or were you sure?
Oh, I totally wanted to go to college. Like I loved reading and I loved art and I wanted to get out of my small town and I wanted to move to New York City. So I was super excited about going to college.
But you wanted to move to New York City because of college or just because there was something here that you had decided you wanted?
There was something here that I decided I wanted.
What was that based on?
Dad living here, right. Like I visited him here. Mm-hmm. I liked it. I liked going to like see movies at Film Forum. Right. I wanted to like work in the theater somehow. Yeah. Right when I moved here, while I was my freshman year of college, I was like a stage manager at La Mama, which is actually like right two here. Blocks away from here. And I just immediately started.
So you knew theater was it?
I was super into theater, and I was like, I want to be involved in this somehow.
And were you acting? You were acting in college, in high school.
In high school, I was acting, but I never wanted to be an actor because I'm a bad actor.
What were you doing? What kind of acting? What plays?
Like, well, I was the star of my high school musical, my senior year of high school, Guys and Dolls.
You did Guys and Dolls.
I did Guys and Dolls, and I was Adelaide, and that was still the high point of my life.
To this day.
Was because I got to like wear tiny sparkly hot pants and like fishnet stockings. Mm-hmm. And I remember like the woman who was supposed to choreograph my dances like got sick or something, like the gym teacher or whatever.
Yeah.
And so I like choreographed all my own dances and like got to wear a blonde wig. And it's
bigger than the Pulitzer.
Bigger than the Yeah. No question. I was happier then.
Really?
Well, that one experience was really, really great.
It's great.
It was totally great. And I remember when it was happening, I was like, I'm never going to get to like star in a musical and like wear tiny, sparkly hot pants ever again.
This is it.
And it was.
Oh.
Yeah.
There's still time, Annie.
Yeah. No. Well, I'm saying it on your podcast in case someone's doing a production of Guys and Dolls somewhere and wants to cast me. I'm available.
I'd watch the email box.
Okay.
You're going to get some weird... Were you serious about the Guys and Dolls?
And I'll say yes.
But I can't do it for scheduling reasons.
I'll clear my schedule.
Yeah. All right, so you come here, and you went to where?
I went to NYU.
Yeah.
And I studied a lot of stuff. I studied playwriting, though. I studied...
Undergrad.
I studied religion.
What school? You're in Tisch school?
Tisch, yeah. I studied playwriting at Tisch.
But you're working at La Mama as a stagehand, is that?
Stage manager. That was like one of my many jobs. I also, all my jobs were very close to here, actually. I worked at St. Mark's Bookshop.
Oh, yeah. It's gone.
I know.
But the La Mama thing, I mean, what was your experience in taking theater in up to the point of you coming here?
There wasn't a lot, which is it's still like very mysterious to me how I ended up being interested in theater and doing theater. And then the fact that I'm a playwright now, I don't totally understand it. I mean, there's like high school theater and I had a great high school drama teacher who showed me lots of good plays.
Yeah.
But I don't know why I liked it so much and I don't know why I was so drawn to it. I still don't totally understand it. To go back to the beginning of our conversation. Yeah. It's always just been like a mysterious thing and I've always been very drawn to it. And there wasn't like a moment when I was like, I love theater. I want to work in theater. No, and so much about theater drives me insane. Like it's sometimes kind of a nightmare. And I feel like when you do theater, you're not really part of the larger cultural conversation.
Yeah.
It's like a weird business. And so I still like I woke up this morning and I was like, why do I do theater? Like, I just was like, ugh. Email that the computers went out last night and there were no sound cues for half the show. And I was just like, why did I do this?
Yeah.
Why did I choose to work in like the most flawed, ephemeral, out of your control medium?
Well, it's not always out of your control. I mean, it's actually more than most contextually very in your control.
Kind of, but something always goes wrong. Like it's sort of impossible to have the perfect show.
Right, because you have actors, you have other elements.
There's so many things that can go wrong. And even if someone sees a really good show, like the next night someone sees the show where there's no doorbell ring. I mean, that's like really beautiful. Like there's something really beautiful about that.
It's human.
Yeah. And like, I'm a huge perfectionist, and you can't ever hit perfection in the theater. Like, it's a crazy goal, because, and you can find the perfect cast, but someone always drops out like 2 weeks before rehearsals.
And also
start,
somebody,
you know,
could, you know, space out. There could be weird moments where it's
people forget their lines every show. That's just the way it goes.
Are they going to get back on track?
Yeah. It's just what happens. Like, people.
Well, that's sort of exciting.
Yeah. But it does, it's like this crazy emotional roller coaster, and watching my own plays, I am like, this is a nightmare and like the greatest adrenaline rush ever. Like, there's something really, it's like both at the same time.
That sounds great.
Yeah, I mean, kind of. It is, you're like living when you watch your own play, and someone forgets their line, but then like remembers it 5 seconds later. Like, you are like, the highs and lows are very extreme.
It's like reading a comment section.
It's just like reading a comment section.
Ooh, nice one.
Oh, man.
Oh, that's horrible.
I did that this morning. I read the comment section for some review in the New York Times.
But wait, we got to go back here, because something must have happened. Let's try to identify.
That made me into theater?
Well, no, but like, you know, La Mama is very specific. And I have to assume like a 19-year-old in that.
I didn't know what it was. There was like a sign on a.
No,
it was,
I know,
like,
but
a sign,
I mean, but
on
once you're
wall.
In it,
yeah,
it was. It's one of the great sort of bastions of experimental theater.
Yeah,
and is that the right use of the word?
I was really impressed that you said it.
And so I had.
I think I wouldn't. I don't know, but it sounds
really
good.
I think it could be used there.
Yeah,
I'll look
bastion.
It up later.
Yeah,
but I have to assume that coming out of what you came from, even, you know, being relatively hip kid, that something must have happened there, like, because I know I don't go to a lot of theater because I can't bear bad theater, and I don't seek it out. I don't seek theater out unless somebody tells me I got to see it. There are plays I've seen in my life that have changed my life.
Like what?
Well, I think that, like, the thing that really blew me away about theater was just how, like, strangely human it was, but just once removed, like, that you would have somebody right there, you know, talking at this pitch, you know, see spit, and it's its own universe, but like, I could touch him, you know, and that connection. I saw a weird amateur production in Albuquerque, New Mexico, of Sam Shepard's Tooth of Crime, I think.
Oh, yeah.
And that's an epic fucking play.
Yeah.
Sort of about the music business. And, you know, there were people I knew in it, because I was a kid that, like, I got a job across from the university when I was 15. So I was very entrenched with art and older people and doing art and being an artist and all that stuff. So this guy I used to work with at the restaurant, Judd, he directed and put up this Tooth of Crime at this, like,
that's
kind of
amazing.
Weird theater space. And the dude who played Crow was this painter in town. Like, so it was this, this vortex of all the local arty people that I kind of knew. And I don't know that I could wrap my mind around the play, really. But I was just sort of amazed at the commitment of it all, and of the spectacle of it all, and of the language of it all.
And it's so vulnerable, too.
Yeah. Oh,
like,
yes,
I feel like being in a play or putting on a play is like the most humiliating, vulnerable thing to do. And then
musicals,
there's
the
yeah,
worst.
That is. But there is something like that's also then really when it works. And you're in the audience, and these people are being so vulnerable.
Right.
It's like, really, you can get like a high off of it.
Well, not just a high, but it's like it's vulnerability and in a space where it's permitted and allowed to be connected with by an audience or others is sort of an elevation of the human spirit. It's sort of why we're here in some weird way. It's a part of being human that gets very, you know, distant from a lot of people.
Yeah, and it's an interaction. Like, even though the actors on stage are pretending you aren't there, like, you know, they know that you're there. Like, everyone's, like, aware, and it is some kind of weird, just, like, human interaction. And that's, I think, one of the things that keeps bringing me back to it, because I do find that, like, most human interactions kind of suck and, like, don't have a lot of meaning in them, and there's a lot of depressing small talk, and like a play is an opportunity to like be in a room with a lot of people and talk about important things or like things that matter to
people. But that's
and get really vulnerable with each other.
Right, but that's interesting that you say that, because of like the type of conversation that is the flick was mundane conversation on the surface, in a way.
Yeah, that's true for part of that play. Yeah, yeah, they are just like shooting the shit.
Yeah, and that, and this whole idea about the requirement of an audience in theater and in that relationship, the fact that you created this set that was unchanging, and it was a movie theater where the seats actually reflected the seats of the theater.
Yeah,
that, you know, that that sort of demands attention. I don't know, you know, how conscious the playwright is of what that mean.
That was like the first thing that came to me when I started writing the play. Like, that was my idea.
That it was going to be set in a movie theater.
With the, like, the fourth wall being the movie screen and, like, a face-off of, like, audience seats. Like, audience, like, a full audience facing an empty audience on stage in, like, theater versus film, kind of, in the physical space.
Which sort of provokes the question as an audience member, like, you know, I guess the most innocent one is like, are we the movie? And, you know, what are our lives? What is this saying about us? Who are these people having this small talk on stage? You know, just sort of like co-workers at an old movie theater, just trying to feel each other out and position themselves in this small world.
Yeah. Yeah.
What was your intention of it?
Was my I mean, I'm so bad at talking about my intentions,
I don't think you should have to.
But what I mean, I did. It was actually just an experience I would have going to the movies. It's like I would go see a really crappy movie,
right?
And then it would be over, and I'd stay till the end of the credits because I just kind of like that. Mm-hmm. It just kind of it gets weird and quiet and awkward, and like the weird flashes of light that happen at the end of the credits and the special thanks and the and then I loved the moment when the lights came on and the ushers came through and started like shit talking each other and sweeping up the popcorn. Mm-hmm. Like that transition from like the magic like time machine of the movies into the like crazy present tense like fluorescent lights on, like some guy in a polo shirt's like sweeping up popcorn. That to me felt like so profound, and I still couldn't really tell you, like I couldn't be like, well, it's profound because you know, like know. Yeah. But to me that moment and that transition, like I wanted it to be both a tribute to the movies, like the power of watching a movie and how jarring it is when a movie's over, and a tribute to like theater, because actually when you're sitting in those audience seats and then the ushers come through, you're kind of just like watching theater, like they're kind of like performing for you a little when they sweep, when they know you're still there.
So
that whole thing was like felt like super potent to me.
And this sort of these characters, which are familiar to any of us in a way, either because we've had jobs like that or we've lived in towns like that, where you have a guy like Sam who is stuck, and because of that, he's become this sort of senior employee. There's a sadness to that guy.
Yeah.
Not unlike the guys at the trash can, I imagine.
Yeah.
Where they seem to have missed or sort of overdreamed themselves into a paralysis where they're not going to ever leave.
Although, yeah. Or I also just feel like most jobs in this country suck. Like, I don't know, I feel like we forget when we like achieve our dreams and like get to interact with other people who like achieve their dreams, that like most people don't get to have the job they'd really like to have. Like, no, most people like don't get their dream job. I mean, I'm saying really obvious shit, but it's that thing where I still think about that all the time.
Or they might not know what it is.
Or they might not know what it is.
They're just surviving because they don't know how to manifest, you know, like you said, their creativity, or because maybe their life has cornered them into a situation. Who knows why?
Maybe, or just like class in this country.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah.
And I just like the guy, like that guy in the play just like didn't get to go to college. And I don't know. I guess I do. I wanted to write about that too. Like,
and when you write plays, like you recognize Shepard when I said it, like, at some point, whether you know why you got into it or not, you know, you had to reckon with what was going to become your life. You had to deal with theater. You had to educate yourself.
Yeah. Although I was just going to say, although I'm not like, I actually am not as well read in theater as I should be. Like, I love theater. I go see theater all the time. I love a lot of, I like love certain playwrights and really studied them. But I got really into Chekhov for many years and like read everything he ever wrote.
What was it about Chekhov that compelled you? Specifically,
just how messy it was, just going back to vulnerability, how like scared and vulnerable everyone in his plays is, and how the conflict in the plays isn't like, because when you take like a playwriting class in college, they tell you that like, it's like a bad acting class. It's like, what do you want? You know, like this character wants this thing, and like this character needs to want like something different, and then they like have to duke it out. And I always hated that kind of writing. And I feel like Chekhov plays really inspired me because they were like, that person doesn't know what they want. That person doesn't know what they want. They think they're projecting like this onto that other person. And now they're both feeling really lonely in the same room together. And that was really exciting to me. And like his plays always felt so much more entertaining to me than plays that had like a really action-packed plot or mm-hmm. something. Mm-hmm. But that said, like I hate reading plays. I love seeing plays. It's like my favorite thing to do, but I really hate reading them, and I'd much rather read a novel like any day of the week.
Sure. So Shakespeare?
I like Shakespeare because I was a high school theater nerd.
Yeah.
So I kind of know a lot of Shakespeare because I was like in Hamlet when I was 15 and I like took a Shakespeare class and got really into it. So that was like, I think if you're a high school theater nerd, you get to know Shakespeare.
Okay, but what did you glean from him as a person who writes plays?
Oh, God. You know, I've never actually thought about like what Shakespeare taught me.
What did you
like
about it?
It feels like a part of my, it's so funny. It like feels like a part of me because I was so young. You know, I was like in Merchant of Venice when I was like 12.
Uh-huh.
I had my first kiss like doing Merchant of Venice with this like cute older boy. Yeah.
Did you feel it?
Oh, I was so into it. And I was like a really unattractive like 12-year-old. He was not into it. And I think he actually like asked the director to cut that. They ended up cutting the kiss from the show.
Oh.
But there was one glorious rehearsal when we got to kiss and I was super, super excited.
Did it hurt your feelings when they cut the
kiss? Yeah, it totally hurt my feeling. I was like, is it, and then you just, I'm still torn.
Unforeseen tragedy of Shakespeare for
just
you.
Just telling you about it, I'm like, is it because I was a bad kisser or is it because.
You were 12.
Or is it because they didn't want it in the play anymore? I don't know. Like, anyway, Shakespeare.
So it felt sort of ingrained to you?
Yeah, those plays just feel like part of the like culture in a weird way in those stories.
Yeah.
And the cool thing about those plays is how little you need to do them. I feel like if you go to most plays in New York, including mine, actually, you have these like incredibly expensive sets that are like trying to represent what a living room looks like or something. And it's really depressing and a lot of money is spent on it. And I think doing Shakespeare in high school, and I feel like a lot of high school kids have this, it's like a way to like get that all you need for theater is like a high school gymnasium. And you know what I mean? And like two props.
Yeah.
And you can like do a really good version of Hamlet. Like
right.
Every scene like takes place in a different place and people are like running around and it's like super. They don't make very good movies. I mean, with some exceptions, but they're so theatrical. But I'm kind of pulling that out of my ass as I talk to you. I didn't like that's not
why.
I haven't
why
had
not
any...
just why not just consider it thinking out loud?
Yeah,
and trust it for a minute.
All right.
I'm not pressuring you.
Yeah. No, it's just that thing where I'm sure you have this all the time. You like
I pull a lot of shit out of my ass.
Yeah, and you listen to yourself or read yourself in print, you're like, I just made that up to have something to say.
Right, or you were just saying something you hadn't thought about it before. But I think that what you said, because I have a hard time with Shakespeare, and I just had Ian McKellen give me a lesson in it face to face.
Yeah,
like he did Shakespeare for me, right, looking at me, and it was sort of mind blowing. And I get that I'm not going to get anything from reading it. Those days are sort of behind me, but if it's played with feeling and focus, that the language connects on an emotional level, even if I don't understand it.
Yeah, it kind of like zaps your brain, that language, in an amazing way. I also think Shakespeare should be performed in smaller spaces,
mm-hmm.
which I actually think is why a group of high school students doing Shakespeare can be the best way to see it. because or sitting at a table mm-hmm. with Ian McKellen mm-hmm. because I do feel like they do Shakespeare in these like huge hoity-toity venues.
There's an and affectation. You're like watching,
yeah, and there's a lot of pomp and circumstance around it.
About honoring the Shakespearean method,
yeah,
as well.
And people have yeah. like weird pseudo British accents when yeah. they do it, even when they're American, and yeah. you know, there's like a lot of pretension around it. And I actually do think that like doing it in a small space without a lot of,
but you took to it.
I did take to it, yeah.
So okay, so you did. You were into Chekhov when you got to college, and you put up a Chekhov play too, right?
Yeah, I adapted Uncle Vanya a couple of years ago.
Was that a great experience for you?
It was a great experience. And we did it actually in a tiny, tiny space. So no one was farther away from the actors than like you and I are from each other. And it was in the round and everyone was sitting on the floor. And we just used all my favorite actors in New York.
Who?
Let's
give them a little love.
Reed Birney, Mike Shannon, Georgia Engel, who was in John.
Yeah, I love
her. You saw last night. Maria Dizia, there's nine people. Matt Mayer, who was in the flick.
Yeah, he's great.
A lot of really great people. It
so
was
you've
just like,
got a crew.
I got a crew, yeah. and I got my crew to do it, and they were amazing.
And
so
what did you want out of that?
I kind of wanted exactly what I got, which was that was actually the most fun I've ever had watching my own work, because it wasn't really my work. Like, it was an opportunity to write and change words around and be kind of a perfectionist with a play I already knew was really good. Mm-hmm. So that whole thing we were talking about of like feeling like a failure and feeling like you didn't make the thing you want to make. Mm-hmm. I just tried to do a really, really loyal translation of a play that I think is amazing and cast really good people in it and work with a really good director and really good designers. And it was super gratifying.
Did Sam Gold direct it?
Yeah, he directed it.
Where'd you meet him?
He did a great job. I met him in 2006 just through mutual friends. Like, his girlfriend, who's now his wife, was my friend and thought we'd work well together. And the guy I was dating at the time was his friend. And, you know, it was yeah. like that weird thing where people are like, you guys should meet and talk. Uh-huh. And then we did.
So in starting to write plays, like, how many are sort of just sitting on your computer still?
There's like three or four just sitting in my computer.
Big plays? Are they
big plays? One was an attempt to write like the my worst nightmare of a play, uh-huh. which was a like two-person play about a romance, uh-huh. With a lot of nudity, because mm-hmm. I always feel like people really exploit stage actors and right. make them take off their clothes all the time. Right. And I'm friends with a lot of actors, and it's just a really intense thing to ask someone to do. So I wrote this play that was like an almost nude two-hander play. Uh-huh. So I'll never show that to anybody. Okay. That was like a personal challenge. Uh-huh. I have some play I wrote that was kind of an attempt to write about me and my mother that didn't work out.
Why?
Those are the two that come to mind. I wrote it. I haven't looked at it in years. It just like just didn't find itself. It like didn't find a higher meaning. There wasn't like I never cracked the like thing above the family drama. And I think at some point I got nervous and tried to add a lot of like plot and action. I remember someone like running out of the room and getting a gun, mm-hmm. you know, it was really bad. And
well, do you think that some of that, like when you say you crack the wall or the ceiling of the drama, that's just something you feel.
Yeah, that's like an intuitive thing. Well, it's that
that's the gift right there.
Well, that's the thing you're moving towards, is that you could write about something very small, like someone sweeping up popcorn mm-hmm. or like a couple in a bed and breakfast, and that somehow if you do it the right way, it like achieves some larger spiritual meaning that you actually can't articulate, or else it wouldn't have that resonant meaning.
And you can't really explain it.
And you can't really explain it, and that's what makes it work. And then sometimes you just write a play and you're like, oh, this has no larger spiritual meaning. It's really just about these people mm-hmm. saying the things they're saying, and it's like not profound, and I don't know why. And usually it comes from me trying to be like, it's that if you try too hard to be profound, or if I have like too big an, or if I'm too sure of what I'm doing, mm-hmm. I feel like that can actually like cripple the thing and make it then mean nothing.
Right.
So you have to like hope that the
parts come
transcendent
together.
Thing happens.
Like, I imagine the thing about you and your mother is probably too personal for you to find that thing.
Maybe. I really admire people who can like write straight autobiographical stuff from there. I mean, I'm sort of glad I can't do it because I feel like my family would be really mad at me.
Yeah. But I've done it. They'll be mad at you.
They'll be mad at me. But I've actually been lucky enough that like my plays really aren't based on specific people or things that have happened to me. That's not really because I'm trying to protect anyone. It's actually just because I need a kind of distance from it. Like, I don't think I could ever write a character based on either of my parents entirely because...
You'd be too self-censoring?
Yeah, I'd be too angry, or I'd be the opposite. I'd either, like, be too easy on them or be too hard on them. I mean, I think that's how we feel about our parents. We, like, excuse weird behavior and then are weirdly hard on them for other behavior. And I feel like to write a character, I need to feel just 100% empathetic towards mm-hmm. them, but mm-hmm. also have like a kind of cold critical distance. And I just like don't know how I could ever write a play about either of my parents that had that kind of appropriate objective right. distance.
And then you don't have the freedom to build a relationship that's completely new with the character you're getting
yeah.
to know.
Yeah. And I feel like I'd have some weird agenda writing right. a play about someone I know. Like I'd be trying to prove some point.
Yeah. And you don't feel like you have an agenda.
No, I definitely do not have an agenda. I mean, if I have an agenda, it's like, I don't want to make plays like all the crappy plays that people who have seen. I mean, it's so crazy. Like I meet so many people who are like, yeah, I don't really like theater. Mm. And I guess my agenda is to like make plays that those people might like.
Get them. Like, that was the conversation we had. I feel like I should at some point, but I don't want to lose this thread, you know, talk about the basic plots of the two plays, because you know most people don't see plays, and
most people don't see plays, or they see plays but like in their town they see like their town production of Tooth
of Crime, or they go to a big Broadway thing.
Or then they go see Wicked. Yeah,
the flick, it takes place in a theater, you know, all in mostly during lights up when these ushers and the projectionist and that job kind of alters a bit, you know, cleaning up. And the characters are Rose, Avery, and Sam. And I think I saw it right, the original cast, right?
Those three. They're still doing it for a couple more weeks.
Now, in building these characters, where did you know? Because there's something I did read in one of the earlier plays that I didn't get to finish. But in the beginning of the play, you sort of created a glossary of absence. That there's...
Oh, yeah.
That there was a glossary of what the different silences were required, that you asked them, whoever was producing the show, to utilize this key of pause, silence, and there was a few. There was like four.
Yeah, I don't do that anymore because so many people told me that I seemed like such an asshole. Like so many people were like, we bought your book of plays and you have this thing at the beginning where you tell people exactly how long to pause and... It seems really, but it is, and I also feel like people know my work well enough now that they sort of know not to speed right. through it. But right. sorry, I interrupted you. Where were
no,
you
no,
going?
No. But see, to me, that's sort of a type of awareness that, you know, you obviously see those periods of silence as being as important, if not more important, than the actual dialogue.
Yes, definitely. Definitely.
Why?
Well, I feel like it sort of goes back to the reason I hate reading plays is because I feel like 80% of theater is like the way it looks, mm-hmm. the physical objects on stage, and like the bodies moving through space, like the way someone crosses their legs or gets up and walks across the room. And that's like so much of the play to me. And I'm so much more I think I am really interested in movement and silence, like movement happening during silence. And yeah, to me, that's just as important as the dialogue in the play. So there are certain directors out there. This is like a big thing in British theater where they like cross out the stage directions. They like don't look at them. It's just the dialogue. And that to me is crazy because I'm trying to orchestrate like a whole event where like the way you push up your glasses is as important as the thing you say.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's true in real life. And
whether we know it or not.
Whether we know it or not. Right. And so I try to be super specific about that in my stage directions and in the play.
Well, I think it's really effective because what's interesting is I know that there was some controversy here in New York about people not liking the flick. And, you know, previous to it winning any sort of awards, yeah. that where it was put up originally, there was some backlash from theater goers. And I was just in a room full of a lot of theater goers.
Right.
And these are not people that I would hang out with. And many of them are much older than me.
Yeah.
And I know who they are. And I, you know, I don't want to stereotype them, but yeah. there is an expectation to what theater is and what it's become.
Yeah.
It's become this strange kind of almost, how do I want to say it? This cultural responsibility of a certain generation of people that's,
totally.
That's a holdover from a different time. Yeah. And their expectations are outdated and sometimes specific. And it's not so much that they necessarily like mainstream things, but they have a definite idea of what theater should provide for them.
Yeah, it should be like people talking really loudly and like debating issues in a really obvious, clear way, and the play should have a really clear message
right,
that you
also,
like take home with you.
But that experience of theater is sort of, you know, not unlike a movie in a certain way. They want to be taken away for a couple of hours with this spectacle.
Yeah.
And you actively fight that by use of silences and also by use of breaking the fourth wall or suggesting that fourth wall is you know, a movie screen, that there is an engagement that's required that is not specifically a spectacle.
Yeah. Well, it's like I don't want it to necessarily be a spectacle, but I want to figure out what is so special about theater, because I actually think you know, there's all this worry in the theater community about like, is theater dead? You know,
always.
People have been talking about this though yeah. for like 75 years.
Right.
But so I just think it's funny that people keep worrying that theater is dead and no one's going to go see theater anymore. But I feel like people react to that by trying to make stuff that's like more entertaining and like more fast moving and like more glitzy. And for me, I feel like the thing theater does, you can like slow time down and we can all be in the room together.
Right. I didn't, just to tell you, I did not feel that either play was long.
Oh, that's great.
At all. I don't know why. It must be why you're good.
Well, a lot of people like complain about how long they are, which is really interesting to me because there's movies that are longer. There's other plays that are longer. That's great.
And I'm not like a theater going person.
Yeah.
But I did not, and I, you know, and I see a lot of live shit. I've been a comedian for a million yeah. years. I don't sit still well. I can't handle a concert, even if it's the fucking Rolling Stones for more than 45 minutes. I'm ready yeah. to go. I get antsy.
Right.
But I did not feel the time. And I don't know why, but it was good. But, and also, like, I think what you're talking about is this insecurity in show business industry in general. To create a pace and an experience that, you know, they're always overcompensating out of complete insecurity of how to keep people engaged and whatever. Now, theater is yeah. a little different, but it's...
No, I think it's very similar in that way. And mm-hmm. this, like, thing where during previews before the plays open, when you can still make changes, you know, I have playwright friends where they'll be like, oh, people didn't laugh enough. I have to, like, change the thing. Or someone walked out. I have to make the play shorter. Mm. And then I feel like that really fucks people up and makes bad theater.
Well, it's not, that's not supposed, you're not supposed to do what do you call it, a test group?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you can have previews and stuff, and there's no, I don't think there's any rule in theater, like if you're a playwright and something isn't effective, you're a director and you talk about it, or you decide to do something, but yeah. not to accommodate laughter necessarily.
Yeah, although I think a lot of people work that way.
Of course. I think that is,
there's just so much fear. I mean, there's fear in like any art form and any medium, especially anything live is like the scariest thing ever. But I feel like theater people are like extra scared and extra worried, and it's like a weirdly conservative medium.
Well, that's because they're pandering to a subscriber base that yeah. they're 90.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, but then it feeds itself, because then when you pander to those people, then interesting young people don't come, and then it just gets worse and worse.
No, absolutely. And I think that the difference between, you know, how what you do, you know, makes its way to Broadway. If it ever needs to be there, like it seems like the theaters that I saw these plays in was a great place to see them. And
yeah.
And once the expectations of ticket sales and all that stuff comes in, even Barry Child couldn't survive on Broadway when he did it.
Yeah. And I kind of think it's just unconscionable. And this is not against anyone who has anything on Broadway, but I kind of think it's unconscionable to charge more than $50 a ticket.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's kind of unconscionable to charge $50 a ticket.
Mm-hmm.
And any more than that is just crazy. It like just becomes some I like don't understand what it is when you're paying like $150 to see a Broadway show. That's just like not a world I'm interested in at all.
And also, I think what you're interested in is really what theater is supposed to be, is that it seems like your struggle with your characters and creating these plays is to sort of, you know, you may not know how it's going to happen, but to sort of elevate the richness of you know what it's supposed to be to feel human and to have your soul connected to something, if you believe in framing it that way.
Yeah.
And you know, finding it through the characters that you do. And I think that is what, you know, why theater was vital to begin with. It was to reconnect us with our humanity. Isn't that right?
Yeah.
So it's sort of lost that focus. And it sounds to me like you want to return to that, you know, and bring in the generation of people that has no experience or desire or necessarily interest or information about what theater is.
Yeah, and I think that's great. You know what I mean? Like, that's my idea. Once a woman came to see one of my plays who had never seen a play before, including like when she was a kid. Mm-hmm. She just was like, "This is the first time I've ever sat in an audience and watched actors on a stage." Mm-hmm. And I was like, "That's my ideal audience member. Like, mm-hmm. I want to make something that works for that person." That's just super interesting to me. And like, how electrifying if the play is good. That must feel to someone who's never seen that before.
What's the biggest struggle that you have, like, in making a play whole?
Like when I'm writing it or when I'm in production?
Well, one thing I noticed last night was that a consistency of character within a character, you know, both emotionally and psychologically. I always find that fascinating because, you know, when you write television, a lot of times they're just writing joke to joke.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean? It really doesn't matter. You know what I mean? Once you get it, the character's broad. A lot of times.
Yeah.
But so when you have the time to do what you do in theater, that the idea that in say John, that the Elias character's childhood, you know, kind of makes sense with who he is as an adult in terms of his emotional issues and psychological issues.
Yeah.
And there it's consistent. And it adds up as a human person. How much of the work is about finding that consistency in having that character be psychologically and emotionally sound as the one you want to create? Are you conscious of it?
A lot of it's unconscious. A lot of it is just like when I'm writing it, realizing that something I've written like somehow isn't true to that character and then having to cut it.
That's intuitive?
It really is. I am really slow. And before I actually start writing the play, I take notes for years. I say like I have like 100 pages on my computer of notes about every single play I've ever written. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is character. It's not character like, why does he do this? He does this because X. But it is just details. Like, oh, he, you know, went to this summer camp and this thing happened to him when he was a baby. And it's his first memory and this and this and this. And just crazy, super, super specific details about their lives. And that sort of, once that document is really long, that sort of, in a weird way, the template for the play. Like, then I sort of know everything about this person, and then I put them in a situation and see what they do. But there's very little planning about what's going to happen in the play, and very little planning about, like, are they going to behave this way because of that?
Right.
There's very little. I think my plays are very psychological, but I try not to be overly psychological while writing them.
Right.
Just because I feel like in real life we do stuff that's like everything's psychological, everything's related to our childhood, but in a very like sneaky, weird, crazy way that we can never really put our finger on.
Right.
And when we think we're like getting to the root of it, we're like farther away than we ever were.
Yeah, because if you get something intellectually, it doesn't mean that it's connected or you can do anything about it.
Well, that was my fear of therapy for so many years, was just that, like, by talking about my childhood and being like, yeah, that's why I couldn't commit to that thing or something, that actually I would be farther away from the answer and farther away from self-knowledge than ever before. Just because, like, the second you pin something down like that, it's probably wrong.
Or it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be able to access your vulnerability in the future to write that course.
Yeah. And I just believe like the self is such a slippery, ever-changing, like viscous, weird, unknowable thing.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's really dangerous to just be like, this is who I am. And so I do.
Some people do that out of fear.
Yeah. Yeah. And just like needing a sense of direction. Mm-hmm. So I think when I'm writing the play, I feel like it's going well when the character like does something that I didn't know they'd do, or that I would have never have predicted they'd do, or they say something totally out of character. And then I think in the end that can feel more like a real person because we do that all the time.
So you let them do that on the page, and it's that, yeah, that excitement of discovery,
yeah,
that comes from writing.
Yeah, that's the best. Like, yeah, that's when I know it's going well, is when I do feel like they're like these crazy figments of my imagination that have taken on a life of their own.
Well, let me set up the other play that I saw, which was John. This takes place at a bed and breakfast in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. A couple comes and they deal with it, because there's so many comedic elements at work all the time in both of your plays that are it's a rare type of comedy. It's very hard to do, and it's not, and it takes a weird confidence and commitment that you don't really see, because you know the emotional depth of what you do as a playwright, it sort of relies on I think you could traditionally call it the slow burn.
Yeah.
You're master of the slow burn. And you know, and that's an amazing, I don't think you incorporate it as a device, or you're conscious of it, but because things get sparse, you know, dialogue wise, when you do hit the closure, you know, whether it's funny or it's painful, or there is this, the punchline is built up through such a deliberate and I don't want to use the word plotting, but a spacious kind of setup for a beat.
Right.
And in both shows, in a couple of areas, you know, that payoff blows the whole fucking thing open and makes the experience that you've just had all the more relevant. It happens with Sam, you know, a couple of times in the flick,
right,
where just something comes out of him where you're like, what is that?
Right.
That's what he's been holding in, or that's what's really going on in that guy. And I guess I'm just praising you, but in the
no, it's really nice.
But in John, it's a much more complicated psychologically, and I think more complicated emotionally, and there are themes that are. I'm not going to say more sophisticated, but your imagination has gone to a different place with that.
Yeah.
And the women characters, like there's this weird undercurrent through the whole thing. It just takes place in this bed and breakfast, and there's a young couple who's, you know, sort of in the last legs or trying to salvage their relationship. And he's a childhood Civil War geek, and she's along for the ride. And they go to this woman's bed and breakfast, and it's classically, you know, the intrusive sort of weird boundaryless bed and breakfast owner.
Yeah.
And then she has a friend who's this you know, slightly, you know, very intense, angry blind woman,
yep,
who has her own story. It's weird with plays. I'm like, no spoilers, but yeah, I can't really describe it. That's what's happening.
Well, and I think that the second you really spend your, this is something I spent years doing, like if you spend your time trying to figure out what other people are thinking,
mm-hmm,
you will go crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Like there is a kind of madness, and we were all doing it all the time, and that's why we're all kind of crazy. But like if you really go full throttle, like I'm going to spend all my time trying to figure out what the person I'm in a relationship is in with this thinking, or I'm going to try to figure out what that person, like you do, there's like a real madness in that.
No, it's horrible. It's because you're usually wrong.
Yeah, there's no way to be right. And then occasionally we like our intuitions are completely correct, but we don't know what people are thinking. We might have like thoughts about what they're doing, but that was something I wanted to, that was like a form of madness that I wanted to tackle with like a character who actually was, who had at one point in her life gone clinically insane.
Because like I fucking get hung up on, you know, the poetry of what makes, you know, theater, and specifically what you're doing, and specifically in that play, compelling, is that you loaded that one up. You know, the flick was, you know, pretty sparse.
Yeah.
And you know what, you were really relying on revelations of the characters to sort of drive the emotions of that thing.
Yeah.
With John, you know, you're setting it, you know, at the, you know, the site of a massacre. a Civil War massacre. You have this environment in this bed and breakfast that suggests an almost mythological universe.
Definitely. And I'd never done that before. That was like a weird challenge to myself. Because I have always written very like sparse plays with very realistic settings, very neutral spaces.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I did, and I also have written plays much more about men than women. You know, I wrote a play once that was like an all male cast, which was The Aliens. And I feel like the flick is actually really about the guys. And I love writing for men, actually. It's really fun. But I was like, why am I not writing for more women? It was sort of a question I was asking myself, and I was getting really interested in just sort of I was like a really weird sort of supernaturally obsessed kid. Like I really did feel like all my stuffed animals were alive and watching me, and that crazy stuff was happening that I didn't understand, and that my parents were atheists, but I was like, there's definitely someone up there controlling this. You know, I was just very, my mother always was like, you would be a religious fanatic if we'd let you. You know, like I built weird little shrines in my room, and I started with this play. I really wanted to go back and investigate that, because it's very like uncool. Like I felt like I was, before I was sort of like writing a play that with these sort of like cool dingy sets about like, I don't know, that there's a kind of like dry kind of like witty coolness to what I was doing.
A detachment.
And a kind of detachment. And I was like, I want to play where like a woman's getting her period the whole time.
Yeah.
And people are talking about going crazy, and there's like dolls everywhere, and they're like, that lady might be an angel. And people like talk about God, because I don't feel like people, I don't know, I do feel, and maybe I'm crazy, but I do feel like we're all wandering around like wondering about God, or if we don't call it God, like the divine or fate all the time, and no one's talking about it. We don't know how to talk to each other about it. Like we don't know how to have those kinds of conversations. And so I was like, I'm just going to write something that's like over the top, like femmy, over the top, like just people like talking about God the whole time. There's going to be magic, but maybe like it's not real magic. Like who the fuck knows? Because I kind of feel like that's what life feels like to me anyway.
In there is going to be this sort of like emotionally stifled.
Well, it's funny. That dude is like, if anyone in that play is me, it's that dude. Yeah. Like it's so funny. So much of me is in that guy, and so much of my history and my life is in that guy. So it's always, so I was like, I want to write a play that's like dealing with like feminine archetypes, but like I'm the dude, like I'm gonna make myself the dude. But yeah, I also like got really into reading all these psychologists at the turn of the century who wrote about religion. I read this one thing, one of the things that inspired the play was this thing I read that like dread is the first step in religious development.
I'm there.
Yeah.
I'm on the precipice.
That's right. And I was like, oh my God. Because as a kid, because I wasn't religious and my parents weren't religious, I was like always scared and always creeped out. Like I always felt like there were ghosts and witches and like something like a hand was about to come out of the ground and grab me. And I never knew why. And I like, until very recently, I was very confused about why I was such like a scared sort of superstitious kid. And I feel like in a way it was my, in like a very secular household, it was my way of trying to access the divine, like something bigger than myself. But sure. I feel like when you're a kid with atheist parents, like the way you do that is almost like through the spooky.
That's
like
true.
Through it's horror, through demons, through horror movies, through scary movies. And that's your way of feeling like, oh man, maybe there's something bigger than me that we can't totally figure out.
Right. And mysterious and unknowable.
Yeah. The mysterious unknowable.
Yeah. The sad thing about dread being the sort of precipice of spiritual awakening, it's also the precipice of a lifelong anxiety problem.
Right. Yeah.
Now, how aware of you are of getting the laugh in comedy? I mean, do you know you're writing comedy?
No, that's the thing. Like every time I now, after every play goes up, I realize it's funny, but I think it's funny because I'm really bad at being intentionally funny. It's just like beyond me. Like I could never write for a sitcom. Really? Like I could never write for I think I'm funny, but I have to be totally relaxed and totally serious, actually.
Like writing a play.
to be funny. Yeah, I have to be alone and not trying to be funny and not thinking about anybody else. And then, but every time I fit, like with John, I was like, this is my not funny play. And then it's like getting all these like yucks in the, when it goes up, it's weird. And then the laughter always surprises me.
But the flick you knew was funny where it was funny.
No, I write
then
it.
Then what is your relationship with Sam Gold then? Somebody is.
Well, I always give him the play and I'm always like, this isn't funny. This is my not funny play. And then he's always like, you're wrong. It's going to be funny. And then it is funny. I mean, it's. I think it's not funny when I'm writing it, but then when we're rehearsing it, I am like hyper specific about timing. Like I drive everybody crazy. Like I'm like, if it's not funny, if you like,
you know when it's supposed to be funny.
Yeah, and I have my very specific sense of humor too. Like there's a kind of laugh that I hate. Like I don't just want laughs. And actually,
you don't want punchline laughs. You don't want turn of phrase laughs.
I don't want punchline laughs, and I don't want like.
That's clever.
Yeah, I don't want that's clever laughs. I want it to be about like I want every laugh to come from a place of like humiliation and recognition.
Sure, the laughter, like I say this on stage sometimes, I said there's no laughter like the laughter that should be crying.
Yes, and my favorite kind of laughter is like sometimes when the whole audience laughs raucously, I'm like no, I fucked up because like everyone thinks they're supposed to laugh right now.
Right.
But my favorite is when like one lady in can't the fifth row just like barks with laughter and everyone else is like, what is she laughing? Like, I like when it's like when I feel like it's individual people having individual experiences. I don't really like the like 300 person crowd
laugh. Believe me, I'm right there with you. I've designed my stand up so it's only for a few people.
That's the way I like it. Yeah. Yeah.
See, this is what makes it great and why when people miss it because they're too worried about their watches is that you have a very specific style and timing.
Yeah.
And well, you know how to honor it.
Oh, well, I know. I do feel like I know exactly, for good or bad, whether you like it or not, I feel like I know exactly how it should be.
Mm-hmm.
And... the thing I want it to be is totally like unexplainable.
Mm-hmm.
Like I want it. And I think one of the reasons I'm not that crazy about the flick anymore. I mean, I'm not that crazy about any play I've written 3 years later and I'm not bashing on it, but I think it like ties. It's like, I started realizing my plays were a little too neat and I felt like they were kind of like tying themselves up in a little bow at the end. Yeah. And with this new one, I really was like, I want it to be a mess.
Right.
Like I'm going to be intentionally make this play like kind of in the end make no sense and make total sense at the same. Like I feel like half the people in the audience will be like that added up to nothing and half the people will be like that made total sense, that was completely cohesive. But I really want to stop trying to explain anything to anybody.
Well, that's good. Well, that just means that for the fight you're fighting for theater and for yourself is to continue growing as an artist, so that's good.
Hopefully.
So are you finding that the people you want to come to the shows are coming?
No, not always, to be honest. I feel more and more like I have an audience and like people, some people know my work and come see it, but I still feel like there's a lot of like rich old people who come see it and then hate it. Like it's that weird thing where they buy all the tickets and then they fucking hate it and walk out halfway through.
That's so funny because like I think it's necessary what you're doing to keep fighting this fight, and it's great that you're getting the attention and the awards and whatever because that will enable you to do that. You will have to be reckoned with by those people, and if they don't want you, then fuck them. Then maybe the other people will come in.
Yeah.
But the fact that theater owners and the theater industry is trying to accommodate them by apologizing for you is fucking heinous, and that's not what art is about. So I think the Pulitzer is going to buy you a few more plays.
That's good. And you know, the theater I'm working at where you saw John has this cool initiative where they only charge $25 per ticket, which just makes me feel better about doing theater in general. Like I always felt weird doing a play somewhere where they charge like $70. I was like, how are you going to get young high school students to come see this?
Mm-hmm.
And Signature, my next two plays are going to be there and all the tickets are $25.
Oh, great.
And that's just like a game changer.
Right. That's great. So you cut that deal and it's just a matter of getting the word out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Now let's come back to Scott Rudin and Faustian deals. Now, do you want to write movies?
So I've written movies. That's how I've like gotten my health insurance since 2008. I was just like a hired. They'd be like, we need rom-com about this, you know, you're a girl, write a, you're a girl, write a rom-com, you know, and so.
This is how they ruin playwrights.
Yes, this is how they ruin playwrights. And then I actually had a total breakdown a few years ago, and I was like, I can't do this anymore. Like, it's paying my bills, but I'm so unhappy, and I'm doing a terrible job. Like, I'm not actually good at writing bad movies. And I actually had a conversation.
So you were doing rewrites.
I was actually doing, like, someone would have an, you know, that thing where they're like, we need someone to write a movie
based on this property we have.
For this property, yeah. We, like, bought this foreign movie, and we need you to do it, you know, blah, blah, blah. But then I had a whole thing where I was like, I can't do this anymore. I quit. Like, I'm just going to leave the industry. And this is why Scott Rudin is amazing. I had a meeting with him and he was like, why don't you want to write movies anymore? Mm-hmm. And I was like, cause I'm done. Cause I write shit. They hate it. Then I get fired off the job. Like, I'm miserable. I have to find another way to do this. And he was like, well, if you could do anything in the movies, what would you do? And I was like, well, I'd write and direct my, like, own weird movie where I had total control. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have to, like, outline it beforehand for a bunch of dippy people. Mm-hmm. And he was like, great. Why don't you do that for me? And I was like, what? Well, I'm just, you know, and then it is my, like, self. I was like, but I'm just, like, this young woman. Like, who would hire me to do, you know? And he was like, well, you should have told me. Like, I didn't know you were interested in directing. Great. Like, I'll pay you to write a script and you can be attached as director. Write whatever you want. You don't have to tell me what it is. Like, just go do it. Shut up, you know?
Are you doing it?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
So
how's it coming?
That's why he's cool. I mean, what I've written so far, I hate. But I'm going to try to get there. Like, I really, really do want to. I am, knowing I can direct it is like a game changer. Because I am so hyper-specific about everything that screenwriting isn't a good profession for me unless I'm directing it.
Well, this sounds exciting.
So he's
it's great.
He's got my loyalty for that one.
It's
great. Yeah.
Well, congratulations on everything.
Thank you.
It's nice talking to
you. Congratulations to you.
Oh, that's very sweet of you. Thank you. Are we good now?
Yeah, we're good.
That's it. That's our show. What an amazing talk I had with her. I love her. I love her work. You should go see her plays if you can. You should see more theater in general. I should see more theater in general. Oh, you hear that familiar buzz? I had to warm up the dirty old man to do my ending licks. Go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF Pod needs. Get on the mailing list, check the calendar, check the episode guides. Get hooked up with Howl.fm over there. Get the Howl app so you can get that WTF archive. Straight telly into the dirty old man.